God doesn't change his opinions. He doesn't change his methods of working or his methods of salvation. We don't believe that early revelation is abrogated by later revelation, as Muslims believe of the Quran. Of course, revelation is progressive. For example, God didn't tell everything that he needed to say to Adam and Eve. If he had, there would have been no need for all the other scriptural record that we subsequently have in 66 books. So obviously there was more that God had to say beyond what he said to Adam and Eve. But at no point has anything he said to Adam and Eve, or Noah, or Abraham, or anyone else throughout biblical history, at no point has he abrogated any of that. It is all still as true today as when it was said in the first place. And if you're saying that you know truth, if you're saying that you know what is truth, then you've got to have something to actually measure that against.
We'll tell you a podcast.
25 feet, 1,000 layers. How many millions of years did that take to form then? The answer is it took 3 hours.
We'll tell you a podcast.
This is the Paul Taylor Podcast, written, presented and produced by me, Paul Taylor, through Proverbs 18:10 Media. You can find out more information, including the RSS feeds necessary for your favorite podcast software, at proverbs1810.org. I hope you enjoy the show. You're listening to the Paul Taylor Podcast, episode 30. In Genesis chapter 9, we read, "And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. But you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. And for your lifeblood I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. And you, be fruitful and multiply, increase greatly on the earth and multiply in it.' God said to Noah and to his sons with him, 'Behold, I establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the livestock, and every beast of the earth with you. As many as came out of the ark, it is for every beast of the earth. I establish my covenant with you, that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth.' God said, 'This is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. When I bring clouds over the earth and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember my covenant that is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, and the water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth.' God said to Noah, 'This is the sign of the covenant that I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth.'" Well, this is the Paul Taylor Podcast, and we have reached episode 30. Thank you for joining us. This is the podcast where I am going through apologetics teaching, and particularly in these last episodes, I've been trying to go through the book of Genesis to give you a foundation to everything. The book of Genesis is the foundation of the entire Bible. And as I said in that introduction, there's no abrogation of anything in the book of Genesis. We build on that. God's revelation was built on that. There's more to say. But at no point is the book of Genesis abrogated. God's method of salvation was always the same right from the beginning, and we discussed that even back in looking at Genesis chapter 3, showing that there was to be the seed of the woman coming, and that the covering of sins was to be by the shedding of blood. So here we are now in Genesis chapter 9. Noah and his family are off the ark, and they have made a sacrifice, an act of worship to God. And now here is God's response. God makes a covenant, and that covenant is with Noah and his family, and therefore with the entire human race. And that's an important point to emphasize, and we'll cover that. But it's the covenant is also with every living creature. And that's what we're going to be looking at. Just before we do start to look at that, though, if you do find these podcasts a blessing, then please consider going over to subscribestar.com/Paul F. Taylor and subscribe there. You will be paying for my time. These podcasts take time to research and to record and to edit. And I would really appreciate it if you felt able to become one of my subscribers there. I do have a small number of subscribers there. They're a great blessing, and I'd love for you to be added to them. I need that finance in order to be able to continue. My tent making job, honestly, does not bring in a huge amount of money. It doesn't really cover the things that I need. My rent is going to go up, and my salary not going up with it. So if you could support me, please, by going to subscribestar.com, I would really appreciate that. It would be great if my subscriber were able to cover at least my rent, and that would be wonderful. And on top of that, if there's anything goes beyond my rent, because rent is not hugely expensive, and if anything I earn above that, I will use to gradually reduce the number of days that I work with the retail store that I work in at the moment, so that I can concentrate more on writing and doing the podcasts. I desperately want to write more on my commentary on Genesis. You know, I've been stalled for a little while. I've been telling you that I'm covering Genesis chapter 20 at the moment, and I've been stalled for several weeks, not being able to find the time to do this. The retail store has been extremely busy over the last 2 weeks. I've done a huge amount of overtime. I have not had the time to sit down and write my comments on Genesis chapter 20. And I, really, if you would like value that book coming out, the way that will happen is if the amount of income that I get through Subscribestar increases, so that I can decrease the amount of work, the number of days that I do, therefore, with the retail store. Well, thank you for considering that. Head over to subscribestar.com/Paul F. Taylor. There are some freebies there. I am publishing on that site PDFs of the chapters that I've written of about Genesis Volume 2. So there are a few there. And I'm about to put up my comments on Genesis Chapter 13. That's going to go up next. So if you will just have a look at subscribestar.com, the Genesis Chapter 13 comments will be there, will be available only for my Subscribestar members. Also, I would say that there is a third podcast. The free-to-air podcasts are this podcast and my sort of political rant podcast, which is called In the Car with Paul Taylor. But I have an infotainment podcast on which is only available on subscribestar.com, which is called My World with Paul Taylor. And on that one, I just reminisce and talk about things to do with Britain, stories, legends, anecdotes, histories, things from my past. And I think you'll find that interesting and fun to find out about. Okay, let's get into Genesis chapter 9 now. In Genesis chapter 9, God is just about to reveal more of his nature to his creatures. He's not abrogating what was said to Adam and Eve, but he's revealing more of his truth. And so This process, by the way, of progressive revelation that I mentioned before, it is now complete. The New Testament is closed, so God's revelation to us is complete. He's not going to be adding a 67th book to the Bible. This episode is not one where I'm going to go through and explain why that's the case, why it has to be just the 66 books of the Bible that we currently have. But I can do so, and I presume that I will get to do that at a later stage on this podcast. Meanwhile, if you want the information right now, the best book on the subject is called Nothing But the Truth by my friend and mentor, Brian H. Edwards. That's Nothing But the Truth by Brian H. Edwards. There are a couple of Christian books with the same title, but it's the one by Brian H. Edwards that I'm particularly pointing you towards, and he explains how Scripture came to be and why it is that we have just those 66 books, why it is complete. So right at the beginning, Adam was given a commission and a command. This was the commission that God gave him. Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. That was Genesis chapter 1 verse 28. Now, Noah is also given a commission, and his commission is a restatement of this. Let me read it to you again, the first two verses of chapter 9. God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they delivered. Now Noah was still to have dominion over all creatures. That was not abrogated. But these creatures are in a sin-affected, flood-devastated world, and they now have a fear and a dread of human beings. You'll notice that fear and dread is the normal reaction of animals today. Wild animals are usually affected by that fear and dread. They will frequently either flee humans or they'll attack humans. They'll flee them or they'll attack them. Either of those responses is due to the fear and dread they have of humans. So, I disturb a deer outside where I live and it runs away. If I disturbed a bear and I was caught between her and her cub, I would likely be attacked. But the reason for both those reactions is the same, the fear and dread of humans. Partnership with animals is desirable, but it's not the natural state anymore. It was in the beginning, but it's not the natural state now. Domestication of animals takes time. And as I'm saying that, my cat is desperately trying to jump up onto my lap. So she is demonstrating that she doesn't have a particular fear in me, nor does my dog. But they have been domesticated. They are, in both cases, they have come from domesticated animals, children of domesticated animals. Generations back, they have been domesticated, and they've been loved and cuddled and stroked. So clearly, my cat is now nestled in my arms, and she doesn't have a fear. But a wild cat looks very similar to this cat. If you went to Scotland and saw one of the Scottish wild cats, or if I saw a bobcat round here, bobcats are a bit bigger than domestic cats, but they look very, very similar. And yet I would not expect one to jump up on my lap and start purring like this creature is doing at the moment. Okay, it would not happen. The domestication of animals takes generations of breeding and care. And I know that everyone's got an anecdote that refutes that point. And I've seen the videos on the YouTube. You get them, the wild animal that comes out of the forest, the baby deer that trots into your kitchen and eats out of your hand and so on. But the reason why we enjoy watching those videos on YouTube and elsewhere is because they're the exception. And those exceptions don't invalidate the general rule, okay? So, you tell me that a bear has come up to you and you haven't been mauled by the bear, instead it's allowed you to tickle it under the chin. Well, maybe that's true. Maybe it's true. It doesn't alter the fact that the majority of bears that you meet, if you get between them and their cubs, you're going to be in trouble. Now, Adam was given a commandment. just one commandment. We've said he was given a commission, he was also given a commandment. And this was the commandment, Genesis chapter 2, verses 16 and 17. You may surely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it you shall surely die. Now, after the flood, the Garden of Eden didn't exist anymore. And that's very important. There are a lot of people today who say, where is the Garden of Eden? And, you know, there are all sorts of people who have theories about where the Garden of Eden is, you know, because the Garden of Eden is supposed to be where the Euphrates and the Tigris join. People assume it's where those two rivers join together before they flow into the Persian Gulf. But it can't be, because the flowing was the other way around. It was the river out of Eden that split into four streams. And by the way, where's the Pishon? Where's those other rivers there that came out of Eden? And you might say, well, it's the same names, Tigris and Euphrates. Well, you know, with respect, so what? I come from Manchester in England. Now, you travel to New Hampshire in, you know, New England in the northeast of the United States, and you can find a sizable city there called Manchester. Manchester, New Hampshire. There are a couple of other Manchesters around. I saw a very small town called Manchester in Washington State. I drove through there one time. Which is the first one? Well, I would suggest it's almost certainly the one in England that is the first Manchester. And the others in the United States were named after that. You know that's the case with other similar towns. In the same way, it's very likely that after the flood, certain features were given names. So after similar geographical features before the flood. So the Tigris and the Euphrates are not the same Tigris and Euphrates that came out of Eden. They've gone. The Garden of Eden is gone. The current Tigris and Euphrates are flowing over sedimentary rock, which was formed during the flood. So the Tigris and Euphrates could not have existed before the flood. Now, the commandment that Adam was given was about not eating of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But that garden is gone, so that tree is gone. Adam and Eve were expelled from the garden anyway. So what standards were Noah and his family to follow? What's the rule that they follow? Well, the standards were manifold. Noah's family still retained that knowledge of good and evil that Adam and Eve had. And they have consciences, just as we read about in Romans chapter 12. Their consciences could tell them, as they do today, what is according to God's law and what's against it. I mentioned Romans chapter 2, in verses 14 to 16, we read this, for when Gentiles who do not have the law, by nature do what the law requires, they're a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. They show that the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them on that day, when according to my gospel, God judges the secrets of men by Christ Jesus. Now, God's law is accompanied by a covenant, and that covenant is based on that law. And so in Genesis chapter 9, we have the first explicit covenant that God made. Now, I know that there are disagreements about how many covenants there are in the Bible. I'm well aware of that. There are some people, dispensationalists, for example, who maintain there are seven covenants in the Bible. On the other hand, there are Presbyterians who would maintain that there are two covenants in the Bible, or maybe just one covenant in the Bible. My reading of Scripture suggests that there are five covenants in the Bible. There wasn't really a covenant with Adam. He had a command, and he had a conscience, and he had a commission. But the first covenant, therefore, is this Noahic covenant. And the Noahic covenant was made by God applying to the whole human race. It's with everybody, whether everybody knows it or not. The majority of people in the world do not know it. And they do not know about Noah. They do not know about God. But nevertheless, this covenant, in the early days, they did know about this. The first few generations all knew. So there was a time when the whole human race did know about the covenant, and they have deliberately forgotten it since then. The Mosaic covenant, which is the one we often think about as being the old covenant, that covenant has been updated, it's been superseded by the new covenant, the Messianic covenant. So that's the Mosaic Covenant. The Mosaic Covenant has been updated. It's been superseded by the Messianic Covenant. So we have, as I said, five covenants. I would say they're the Noahic Covenant, the Abrahamic Covenant, which we'll come to later, the Mosaic Covenant, which is the only one that no longer holds sway. There's the Davidic Covenant, the Kingly Covenant, and there's the Messianic Covenant, or the New Covenant. Four of those covenants, therefore, are still in, they still apply today. So this Noahic Covenant still applies today. It wasn't a covenant that was restricted just to this early post-flood era. It is not a covenant for a particular dispensation that then disappears. It's a covenant that still applies today. And there's considerable discussion, therefore, as I said, over how many covenants there are in the Bible. And I've just mentioned some of the ideas that there are over that. Now, the Noahic Covenant concerns how humanity is to govern itself in a godly society. This is what we read. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. But you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. For your lifeblood I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. And you be fruitful and multiply, increase greatly on the earth and multiply in it. The first element then is that God lifts the restriction he made in Genesis chapter 2. In Genesis chapter 2, which was before there was sin, then he made the command that there was to be that people were to eat only plants. Animals were to eat only plants. Human beings were to eat only plants. Now there is sin in the world. After Genesis chapter 3, there is sin in the world. And this regulation now made in Genesis chapter 9, where people can now eat animals as well as plants, is a permissive regulation. It recognizes that the fall of man has resulted in some animals eating other animals. And it's also possible that mutations in people now made it more difficult for them to ingest the right quality of protein to stay healthy. For example, animal protein usually contains all the amino acids necessary for our bodies, whereas most plant protein does not. And that means that vegetarian meals have to be balanced to contain, they have to be carefully balanced. They must have a balance of different food groups. Now, we should note that the verse doesn't make it mandatory to eat meat. It says you are permitted to eat meat. Therefore, it's perfectly in order for people to choose to be vegetarian or vegan. If you have decided on that you're going to follow a vegetarian diet or a vegan diet, you have not sinned. I'm not going to tell you you sinned. Now, I think that you are misinformed, and particularly those of you who are vegetarians or vegans have no right to tell me that I shouldn't eat meat. But you see, it's no longer possible in the post-flood world to mandate vegetarianism or veganism. But it's completely in order for people to eat meat. But if a Christian chooses to be vegetarian, God bless you, but please check that your vegetarian is not based on a false evolutionary view. Because I've even heard some Christians say, well, you know, animals are a higher form of life than plants. They're closer to us. That's not the case. We are completely separated from the animals. That was the point, remember, of Adam being asked to name all the animals, God showing him that there was no possible helpmeet, there was no possible mate among the animals. Adam is completely different. Although made of the same chemicals, although having a body that works in a similar way because of God's economy of design, nevertheless, spiritually and in every way that's important and interesting, human beings are completely different from animals. So if your vegetarianism is based on evolution, then it is wrong. If your vegetarianism is based on the fact that you simply don't want to eat meat, God bless you, you're not sinning, okay? Now, the restriction, the lifting of the restriction on meat eating emphasizes the care that we need to consider with the importance of blood. Leviticus 17:11 reminds us that the life of the flesh is in the blood. And remember that the word life there is the word nephesh in Hebrew. We discussed that at length several weeks ago when we were looking at those issues before. Now, Genesis chapter 9 verse 4 contains the elements life, flesh, and blood. There are some people, therefore, who consider that that means we shouldn't consume products containing blood. And there are therefore some people who take it further and say, well, we shouldn't eat red meat. Others say, well, red meat's okay if the animal was killed according to kosher practices. But you've got to remember that Peter was told not to call anything unclean that God had declared clean. That's in Acts chapter 10. So I suggest that the verse is simply referring to not eating animals alive when they've got the life of the flowing blood in them. You're not to start eating an animal while it's alive. Even then, you're referring there to nephesh animals with blood. Really we're talking about vertebrate animals, not even vertebrate animals, but land animals. We're talking about not eating them while they're alive. I don't think that prohibition, for example, stems to not eating oysters. You really need to eat many shellfish either very quickly after they've died or even to eat them alive. Most people like to eat oysters alive. I know oysters are not kosher, but again, we don't have to follow kosher practices. So I don't see that there is anything wrong with eating oysters, eating them straight out of the shells. They are not nephesh animals. They're not the same type of animals. I'm saying even animals that we would eat, boned, meaty animals, even animals that we would eat, we shouldn't be eating them alive. So, you know, you don't go and take a big bite out of a cow in the field. Man, you should kick you anyway, but you get the idea, you know, we're talking about. It's part of our responsibility towards and our stewardship of creation. And some of you may think I'm simply making an excuse so that I can go on eating one of my favourite foods, which is black pudding. Black pudding is made entirely from pig's blood, and I love that stuff. It's made in the northwest of England, and it's probably years since I've had any, but I always used to enjoy it. It's something that people have in the Manchester area for breakfast, along with bacon and eggs and sausage and baked beans, by the way. That's something else we have there. But I don't think that's what the text is saying. I don't think that black pudding is being prohibited by this verse that we've been discussing. I think the purpose of the text is to show us that we have to have respect towards the shedding of blood, without which there is no remission of sins. That's why I'm in favour of animals being killed humanely. And what's humane, of course, will have developed over the years. But, you know, if we can minimise suffering of animals, then we should do so. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't kill them, okay? It doesn't mean it's wrong to kill them. It doesn't mean that I'm against hunting, for example. And you might say, well, an animal with a bullet in might suffer for a while. It's unfortunate. It's not the intention. A good hunter is not going to leave an animal suffering. And it's an inexperienced hunter or a poor hunter who is going to do so. Okay. Well, just to round that off, I've said about seeing nothing unbiblical in eating oysters. By the way, although I say there's nothing sinful about eating oysters, I don't do it. If you want to eat oysters, fine. I'm not going to do it, and that's simply because I've seen too many people I know getting very ill with food poisoning from oysters. That's the reason that I'm going to eat them. It's not sinful to eat oysters. There are many people who love it and are happy to do that and are happy to take the food risk. And there are many other things that I'm happy to take a risk with. But I'm not going to take a risk with oysters. That's my personal preference. There's nothing sinful about me not eating them. There's nothing sinful about you eating them. Okay, this is our offering. This is our choice. Okay. Well, God proceeds from referring to animal blood to referring to the death of humans. And clearly this is the more important issue, particularly the death of humans at the hands of fellow humans. And we now see an important new biblical law. And this biblical law covers the Cain and Abel situation. But you can't go back and apply that to Cain and Abel. But when we discussed Cain and Abel in Genesis chapter 4, we saw how Cain was not killed. God could have introduced that law at that time if he wanted, but he chose to introduce it at this point under a covenant that was going to be accompanied by a symbol. So let's again remind ourselves, God is not changing his mind. It's simply that Revelation is progressive. The fact that Revelation is progressive doesn't mean that the earlier verses are abrogated. Remember that the purpose of what was being played out, the true history that was being played out in Genesis chapter 4, was to show about the first blood being shed. And therefore it was important that Cain should stay alive so that people would know the consequences of the first blood being shed that points towards the shedding of the blood of Jesus Christ. Now, I am going to be a bit controversial here, okay? It seems to me that what God is saying here in Genesis chapter 9 is the initiation of the death penalty for murder. Now, that deterrent wasn't in place at the time of Cain, but now, in the new post-flood world, God puts the death penalty in place for murder. Now, we've already stated that the Noahic covenant has not been superseded. It therefore follows that the appropriate penalty for murder in human societies is still the death penalty. Now, you see, the Mosaic law defines a large number of crimes or sins for which the death penalty was appropriate. There are some people who take a theonomic view of those who say that they should still be in operation today, those death penalties in the Mosaic law. On the other hand, dispensationalists usually tend to suggest that the penalties applying to breaking the Mosaic laws do not apply under the Messianic covenant, even if the sin still holds. Now, I'm not going to discuss the relative merits here of theonomy and dispensationalism. I probably lean more towards the theonomic point of view, but I'm not going to look at the relative merits of them at the moment. I just want to point out that even if you hold to the dispensational view of Mosaic law, which is saying that the death penalties for various crimes under the Mosaic law don't apply today, that's got nothing to do with the death penalty for murder. So even if you're going to order that other death penalties do not apply. Personally, I think that the death penalty should apply for rape, okay? That's something under the Mosaic law. But if you're somebody who says, no, the death penalty should not apply for rape, I think you need to do some more exegesis to justify that. But even so, even if you felt that that's the way that things should be, you have to accept that the death penalty for murder is still in place. There's no doubt about that, because the Noahic covenant is still in place. And the death penalty for murder is not part of the Mosaic covenant. It's the Noahic covenant that God made with the whole of the human race. So there is no biblical argument against the death penalty for murder. I used to describe one, you know, in my 20s, I was quite soft on the subject. I remember having a discussion on this, a formal debate in which I took the opposite view. But over the years, I've come to read the Bible more accurately, more carefully, particularly as I've gone through studying Genesis. And it's very important, therefore, to note that the death penalty for murder is the only correct justice for such cases. Societies that have abolished the death penalty for murder have done so in opposition to the teaching of Scripture. And that's a very, very important point indeed. Now, you might wonder why there are no other laws stated at this point. I don't know why God didn't give all his revelation to Noah. I don't know why he didn't give a totality revelation to Adam. But in his sovereignty, that's how God has chosen to act. The overarching commitment to human society makes one requirement, that human beings respect blood and apply the death penalty for murder. Well, in verses 8 through 10 of chapter 9, God shows that the covenant is made to Noah, his sons, and all their offspring forever. And that means all of humanity forever. But you'll notice that the covenant also extends to animals. The whole of life in the new world after the flood was to be placed under this covenant. It applies to all nephesh life. God's promise then under the covenant was that he would never again destroy all flesh or flood the earth in its entirety. Now, that doesn't mean that our current world is going to last forever. God has clearly stated that he's going to bring it to an end. And there's an implication about that even before the flood in the prophecy of Enoch. But one day God will bring it all to a close and he'll make a perfect new heavens and new earth. What it does do is it leaves the worldwide flood as a permanent type of the judgment to come. And the ark as a permanent type of the salvation which is available. The engine driving the onset of the flood involved rain, and therefore it's appropriate that the sign of the Noahic covenant is a rainbow. And today, every time you see a rainbow in the sky, you should remember that that is a universal symbol to tell us that God has judged the world, God has had mercy on the world, and God is not going to send another flood. Now, the rainbow is a universal symbol, it's seen everywhere, and it involves the refraction of light by raindrops, so it can occur whenever there's rain. It won't always be seen whenever there's rain, but it can possibly occur when there's rain. Now, it reminds us that God's judgment, therefore, will not come by the same method. That's why it's a very appropriate symbol to remind us about the Noahic covenant. It reminds us also that there is going to be a judgment, and that judgment is going to be in God's timing. It's very interesting, of course, that the rainbow has been used for other purposes. It's used today to describe the LGBT community, people who are going, who are committing sins, which the Bible refers to as an abomination. And they have taken to themselves, in order to celebrate their abominations, they have taken to themselves a symbol which is a symbol of the covenant of God's wrath, God's judgment, God's mercy, and God's salvation. And it's very interesting and not at all surprising that that has happened. We, however, need to emphasize that the rainbow is our symbol. It's not theirs, it's our symbol. And as we can see in Genesis chapter 9, it's there because of the covenant. By the way, we've already discussed that we don't know if there was rain or not before the flood, only that there was no rain during the creation week. It is therefore possible and perfectly biblical that there was rain before the flood, and therefore there might have been rainbows before the flood. Now, this is what John Calvin says about this. These words, certain eminent theologians have been induced to deny that there was any rainbow before the deluge, which is frivolous. For the words of Moses do not signify that a bow was then formed, which did not previously exist, but that a mark was engraven upon it, which should give a sign of the divine favour towards men. You get the idea? It doesn't matter whether there were rainbows or not before the flood. I suspect there probably were. There was a time when I thought there weren't, because there was a time when I talked about there being no rain before the flood. But I've already explained earlier in these podcasts that that's not the position I take today. We cannot tell whether there was rain before the flood. All we can say from what Scripture says is that there was no rain in the creation week. That's all we can say. We cannot say that there was no rain before the flood. Remember that the main engine for the flood was not even the rain. The rain was there, but the main engine was, of course, the volcanic activity that we've talked about, the fountains of the deep. So it is perfectly possible that God took a sign which already existed, as John Calvin said, and applied it to this Noahic covenant. By the way, the keeping, the sign is for our benefit, but the keeping of the remembrance is upon God. Do you notice that? The signs for us to remember the covenant, but the keeping of the covenant, the remembrance of the covenant, is for God. It's when God sees the bow in the clouds that he remembers his covenant. Now, in a possible allusion to the flood, Habakkuk refers to God unsheathing his bow. You read that in Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 9. And at the end of the flood, God resheathed his bow, and the striving against humanity from before the flood had now ceased to be replaced with judgment, covenant, and salvation. This is what Hamilton says about it. He says, a common motif in ancient Near Eastern iconography is that of a bow-wielding deity. The bow's placement in the cloud points to the cessation of God's hostilities against mankind. Now, it's very easy to misunderstand the purpose that God had for the flood, even among those of us who acknowledge it was a real historic event. We addressed earlier the fact that the flood was planned by God. It was not a reaction to unexpectedly sinful events. God knew that those events were going to happen. He foretold them. He was in control. He was sovereign. It was divine judgment. The flood was indeed divine judgment on sinful people, but it was not unexpected. The flood wasn't a failed attempt by God to reset the world to what he had in the Garden of Eden. At no point was there any implication that the post-flood world was going to be a perfect Edenic world. And it clearly was not. When we read that the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually, God is not saying that man will now be perfect after the flood. And so the surface of the earth is barely dry, but we begin to see that there are problems about to arise. I say that the surface of the earth was barely dry as a sort of hyperbole. In fact, the events of the second half of Genesis 9 may have been a while later, because there had to be time for Noah to plant his vineyard and then for him to make wine. But where we'll just leave it for today is to note the fact that in verses 18 and 19, we read that the whole population of the world today is descended from Noah's three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And we're going to read more about that, a greater explanation of that, in Genesis chapter 10. So that will do for now. It's the first half of Genesis chapter 9, and we're going to go on to Noah's vineyard. We'll have a look at that next week. But I think we've covered quite a lot today. We've covered the fact that God set his bow in the clouds as a sign of a covenant. It's a covenant that he made with the whole of the human race. He was adding revelation to what had come before, but not changing it. Everything that had gone before is still true. God is just revealing a bit more and a bit more of himself until the final book of the Bible was written. And after that, the canon of scripture is closed. But at this stage in history, in Genesis chapter 9, God is still unfolding his work. As I said again, I'll emphasize it over and over again, he has not changed his mind on what's gone earlier. There is no abrogation. There's nothing, with the fact that there's now the death penalty for murder is not an abrogation of Genesis chapter 4. You've got to see them in context. Genesis chapter 4 had to happen that way before the idea of the revealing of the death penalty for murder, so that the life of Cain would remind people that the blood of Abel was the prophecy of Abel that points towards a greater blood, the blood of the Messiah. And of course we read that in the book of Hebrews. Well, thank you for listening to this podcast. I hope you find it helpful. I hope it's a blessing to you. If it is a blessing to you, please remember that you can support this work by going to subscribestar.com/PaulFTaylor. I badly need your subscriptions. Please consider that. It will help me a great deal, bless me, and enable me to carry on making these podcasts, and God willing, to be able to write the books that I've explained to you that I'm wanting to write. So meanwhile, remember, as always, keep your podcasting software up to date. May God bless you. Thank you for listening to this podcast.